Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
Hey, I'm Rob Riggle.
This is Marlon Wayans.
I'm Eli Roth.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Hey, guys, this is Jeff Probst, and you're listening to The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
There are a few people in life that you meet that you just adore and you just have a kinship with and you feel like you've known them forever. My next guest is that for me. Nina Jacobson was my partner for way too short of a time. If you've listened to this podcast more than once, you've heard her name because she's been influential in everything I've done in my career as an executive and certainly as a producer. Meeting her and learning from her was one of the highlights of my career. And the amount of success that she has had, both as an executive and as a producer, is nothing short of astounding. She is nominated for multiple Golden Globe Awards for Crazy Rich Asians, for Pose, and for The Assassination of Johnny Versace. She has incredible taste. She has produced huge, huge blockbuster franchises like The Hunger Games. She's a remarkably smart and thoughtful, caring person, and I'm just completely in love with her. And can't be more happy for all the success that she has had. We have a wide-ranging discussion of all things about, you know, what makes a good partnership. We went through a lot of political turmoil together when we were executives, and it was a great hour of being able to reminisce and go back through the past. It was like talking to someone that you've known pretty much all your life. So enjoy this conversation. She is one of my favorite people, as you can tell, and also by far one of the most successful producers working today. Enjoy. All right, Nina Jacobson. Hi.
Hi.
Do you know that your name has been brought up more on this podcast than any other name by a factor of 10?
No way.
Yes, swear to God. I think every episode, one or both of us have mentioned your name, and just all the people that you've touched that have been on this. I just had John Chu on, Rob Cohen. I mean, every person has some story of either you being executive or a producer back in the day.
That's crazy.
Well, I'm so happy to have you on here. I really have wanted to, besides the fact that we talk about you all the time, I'm such a big fan of yours. Both professionally and personally. I've liked everything you've done professionally. And I got to say, I've said this a few times on my podcast, one of my biggest regrets is not having the chance to be partners with you longer. It was a bummer the way that the whole thing went down at Disney.
But we had fun.
Yeah, we did it for a while. And
I begged you to stay. You remember that? Because I was pregnant, but I don't think did I tell you that at the time, or I wasn't telling yet?
And so I don't think you said
anything. I was like,
please
don't go, please don't go, please don't go. Because I was super early in being pregnant. And then when you left, I had to say to them, like, okay, yes, I would like to hold on to this job and do it myself at this point. But, like, heads up. I'm pregnant.
And it's such a weird, complicated story of how we ended up partners, and we'll get there. But I want to talk to you first about you were born in Brentwood.
Yep.
Grew up in Brentwood.
Yep.
Then went to Brown.
Yep.
But did you study film in Brown? What was your goal when you were in Brentwood? I mean, you were around the movie business, obviously. What was your aspiration when you were a kid?
Well, it's funny because even though I did grow up in Brentwood, I went to Pali High. We did not know movie business people. The only person who my family knew who was in the business was Dick Sherman of the Sherman Brothers, mm-hmm. right? So that was like our one Hollywood friend. And other than that, all my friends at school, like none of their families were in the business. Mm-hmm. And it was a very different time. We didn't like follow the industry the way that people do now.
Right.
And so you might not have even known who was who and who did what. And so I didn't have any real connection to the movie business, and I didn't have any expectation at all that I would do that when I went to college. I was super nerdy. I spent most of my school years before college first thinking I wanted to be a veterinarian, then I wanted to be a doctor, and then I went to Andover Summer Session when I was 16. And I took a photography major, and I was in class with Michael Bay.
Oh, wow.
and I took a psychology minor. And when we had our show, my psychology teacher came to it and was really complimentary about my photographs. And she was like, you know, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, you know, I could see this as a hobby. My dad's a photographer for a hobby, but obviously I'll have to get like a real job at some point. And then she was like, well, actually people have jobs that are real jobs where they do things like this. And it was sort of like a little earworm that started to work its way through. And so I still really didn't know what I wanted to do. But when I got to Brown, the subject that I started to do theater, which I loved, and that was like my, you know, side gig.
As in, like an actor? Or
no, no. A stage manager.
Okay.
You know, I was a stage manager. I loved it. And I really enjoyed
that. Which is pretty much what our jobs are now, by the way. We're just stage managers.
Totally. And I loved it. I loved the whole urgency and excitement of, like, we're putting on the show and things go wrong and you have to fix them. And I loved that. And then I started studying what was then called semiotics at Brown. It is now called the Center for Modern Media and Culture. But it was really like a critical theory and a way of looking at texts. And those texts included films, but you could also use semiotics to interpret and read, you know, a book or a comic book. Right. But I started to study film theory, and I started to fall in love with every movie I watched and trying to, like, dig deeper to understand more of how meaning was created within that film. And I fell in love really with movies. I'd always liked watching them, but I fell in love with studying them.
Do you remember movies growing up that affected you? Like just in high school before you knew all the theory and semiotics?
Well, I mean, of course, because we're like that generation that grew up on Spielberg films and on E.T. and Raiders and Star Wars. I mean, you know, not that that was Spielberg, but, you know, we grew up on those. Mm-hmm. Jaws, all of those big kind of communal experiences. And then – but when I got to Brown, I was studying much more – older films, foreign films. So I loved Bergman. I loved Hitchcock. I loved Jean-Luc Godard. And I, you know.
And so were you in your class, they were showing you these films, then you guys would all dig into them and try to figure out, you know, kind of what was underneath them all?
Yes.
And were you a voracious reader growing up?
Yes. I was always a big reader. I always love a good story. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really until – but even as I was studying at Brown, I thought maybe I'd go into documentaries. I really developed a political conscience. I wanted to do things that sort of challenged the status quo. And when I first graduated, I had gotten an internship. I actually took a class at SC. I took some classes at SC my junior year. Took a semester here in LA, studied at a film school.
And were they theory classes or were they practical classes?
They were both. There was like a class on radical documentaries. They weren't really – I wasn't making a movie there, but I did end up making a super pretentious senior thesis performance art piece.
Unbearably pretentious.
I've made a terrible mistake.
Yes, you have.
Yes.
So wait a second. Did you film this pretentious performance piece? Were you in this pretentious performance piece?
Yes.
What was the theme of this piece?
Called Lost, and it was actually a kind of metaphor for – so when you study semiotics, it's incredibly esoteric, high theory, right? Mm-hmm. And I started to have doubts about, like, what could this matter? How could this matter if your goal or if you have a longing for social change? How can this subject that can only be understood by people who have studied it virtually, how could it impact anybody? And I started to question what I was studying in terms of its theoretical underpinnings and wondering, like, but what is the real-world impact? And so it was like a mixed media thing, and it was a film that involved me like wandering in dunes in Cape Cod. It was terribly pretentious.
What was it shot on? Was it shot on 16?
16.
And so you shot it and edited it and did it all yourself, or did you have a whole crew of people?
No, it was very solo. And, you know, and it, like say, and then it projected images onto people. It was very pretentious, and I don't luckily seem to have a copy of it, so I don't have to endure. But I did love all of the, like, getting to go
the
in there and
of it, right.
At the time, you know, you would cut it, physically cut the film and all that. I loved all of that. But I started working. I got an internship as a researcher for documentaries in my junior year at working for Arnold Shapiro, who was, had done Scared Straight and was making documentaries for TV. This was before the advent of reality TV, which is where all of those folks ended up. When I graduated, they offered me a job, and so I was a full-time researcher. And I loved the research part because I'm nerdy and I like that kind of thing. But I started to realize very quickly, like, oh, whoever's financing this documentary actually gets to say what we can talk about or not.
Right.
And so if it was – we did one that was about, you know, crime, and it was – I did my research. I was like, okay, so the most prevalent form of crime is black-on-black crime. And they're like, yeah, it's not really very fun. People want to do, like, serial killers, kidnapping, you know, things that are a little sexier. I was like, yeah, but this is – you're much more likely as a black person, you know, it was like that the cause of death for black men, you know, from 18 to 39, like the number one cause of death was homicide at that time.
Right.
And so you were like, that seems pertinent. And they're like, yeah, it's not really what our audience wants to see. And then we did one that was – like about the anniversary of the Air Force. And I was like, well, we got to talk about the Enola Gay. And they're like, yeah, it's kind of a bummer. You're like, well, yeah, it is kind of a bummer.
Right.
But, and so I started to realize, well, if I'm going to have to make creative concessions based on who's writing the checks, why not free myself from having to talk about things that have actually happened? Why not get to make things up?
I will say this. It's so fascinating to me because as I do this and we talk and about the past and things that maybe you haven't talked about in a while, I see patterns. That is exactly your career, what you just described. You have made a career of making things that you care about, that you think are important, that the people financing him goes, eh, I don't know. Really, you want to see really Asians and really, you know, the show Pose and really all these things. You're always fighting against that. And you're always right that it is what the audience wants to see. All of these, you know, different cultures and different things that, you know, are underserved by the, you know, quote unquote, you know, big media. You've really done that since your entire career, and it's paid off in spades. And that all started when you were saying, I don't really want to be told what to do.
Yeah. No, there's definitely – I have a definite, like, question authority impulse, which was cultivated for sure by my Brown education.
Right.
And, you know, and don't assume that the status quo – really is justifiable.
Right.
It's just the status quo, and there's always a reason behind it. You know, there's always like who's in charge? Where's the power coming from? What's the motivation for keeping things the way they are?
Right.
And so I ended up starting to want to branch out. This is where, we didn't really know people in the business, but my dad my dad was an early adopter of computers because that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
So he was like, you get a creative directory. You tell me the companies you're kind of businesses you would be interested in, and I will help you with a word processing program that says, dear, you know, blah. I'm looking for an entry-level job in the field of blah, which has always fascinated me, and your company in particular, blah.
Right.
So we did this, and I was like, Dad, I know this is not going to work. I mean, I'll do it for you because you've just, you know, you and Mom have paid for my college education. It's the least I can do. And so we sent out like a zillion letters, and I actually got a ton of phone calls.
Wait a second. So you went to like Samuel French and got a creative directory, which back in the day was the only way to know what was going on. It was a bound, like, spiral notebook that was, you know, about 2 inches thick that had little tabs in it, and you would go through and say,
documentary filmmakers, television. And I got a bunch of calls from that, but the thing that actually turned into my job was that my dad, through the most remote connection, knew, like, Lauren Shuler Donner's brother-in-law.
Wow.
And she agreed to meet with me because I was a girl looking to get in the business.
Great.
Which always really impacted me and something I always try to do in turn. And so she then hired me to do freelance research for features and say, okay, we want to do a movie about Pancho Villa. And so you go do the research on him.
Yeah.
Or on, you know, Wild Bill Donovan. You go do the research. And so and then from there – she and a guy who worked for her, Rick Solomon, they would let me know when a job would open up because I had no way of knowing.
Right.
And so a job opened up at the Disney Sunday Movie working for Donald DeLine. And they told me, okay, go interview for this job. I was also doing freelance script reading at that point. That had some of which came about because of the crazy form letters.
And were you doing freelance script reading? Was that the first screenplay you ever read when you got that job?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Because we weren't – certainly at the time, I think now it's probably quite different. But at the time, Brown was – it was very much geared towards – creating your own films, watching films, but not necessarily studying the business. And also, I was very my taste was not that mainstream taste when I was in college. I didn't realize, I don't think, until I started to get into the business, actually how much my taste was more mainstream and how much I really – what appealed to me was rather than make these super like radical documentaries for people who already – feel the same way you do. Mm-hmm. If you could make popcorn movies, populist entertainment that communicated your values or values that matter to you, they might cause people just to think differently, incremental change, right, as opposed to trying to like reinvent the wheel, but only for people who already are interested in wheel reinvention. Like, well, what meaning could you bring into a movie like Game Plan?
Right. You know? Yeah, exactly.
And so, which I can talk about in a bit, which I did with Audrey Wells and I, as an example, but or Princess Diaries or whatever.
Right.
And so I ended up getting this job at the Disney Sunday Movie as a full-time script reader. And, you know, I'd read like two scripts a day, do coverage on them. And, you know, I loved it. And then 6 months in, the writer's strike of 1988 happened.
Wow.
And I got laid off. And, you know, I've been like an overachiever my whole life. I'd never had like something like that happen, just like the rug pulled out from under you. And the only person who's hiring was Joel Silver.
Oh, gosh.
And, you know, and that was like the not at all the type of movie I thought I wanted to make or anything like that. But he was hiring, even though there was a writer's strike. That was the job.
Right.
Again, you know, the folks at Lauren Shuler's company gave me the heads up, go in, interview for this job, and I got the job.
How was that?
You know, it was an amazing education.
I mean, that was at the pinnacle of his success,
exactly,
too, at Warner Brothers, making Lethal Weapon, making, you know, all of those giant action movies at that time.
Yes, and I got to read some amazing writers,
right,
you know, and to really appreciate whatever, a Frank Darabont and mm-hmm. his work, you know. There were – to get to – you were – I was getting to read amazing writers mm-hmm. who were up at the top of their field, and I was getting to know my own taste and to be able to connect with writers and their agents through – I've read this and I can talk about it. And that became sort of like the backbone of my career was – I could read things and have a point of view about them, and I could connect with the person who wrote them, which has like always been my – those are my core relationships, have always been, you know, with writers, with writer-directors, ultimately with directors. But at the beginning, it was all about Billy Bob Thornton, and, you know, he and his then-writing partner had written a script that I loved, and we got to know each other. And then when – 6 months into the job at Joel's, the woman who had brought me in, Riley Ellis, walked into my office, said, I'm leaving. Here's my Rolodex. You'll be fine. I am 23 years old. I have no idea what I'm doing. And now suddenly this really busy company, I'm the most senior film executive, and I am not qualified for that job. And I'm having to call my friends all the time to be like, can you tell me what's turnaround? What does it mean? I don't know what this word means. And so there was a 6 month period where I was scrambling to kind of, you know, learn as fast as I could. I knew that they would bring somebody in above me, as well they should. What I did not know was that the future of that company was not going to include me.
Right.
And so then I had this experience where my friend Rick Solomon says, bad news, I just talked to somebody who came from an interview for your job that you have right now.
Well, that's nice that you still had people giving you the heads up, so you weren't just blindsided
every
time.
Yes, that's true. At least I got the heads up.
Right.
And then I had to go and, you know, ask Joel, and he initially denied it, and then he was like, why, what have you heard? And then I had to tell him what I'd heard, and then
– such a Hollywood story.
It was. And so then I'm like 18 months in the business. Now it's my second time being fired.
Right.
And so at that point, though, I did know some agents because I had connected with their clients. And Tom Strickler actually put me in touch with Walter Parks and Laurie McDonald. They were hiring. And I went
and was
to
this,
work.
This was at the time when Strickler was at ICM, or was he – because Endeavor had not been formed
yet. It wasn't.
Right?
It was definitely pre-Endeavor.
Right. Okay. But I will say your skill of being able to talk to writers and, you know, be able to communicate your thoughts to them and bond with them and care about them is what propelled your career forward from that point. I mean, calling a bunch of agents and knowing what turnaround is not – I mean, anybody can do that. Your skill of being able to read something and dissect it, probably from your love of reading and your experience at Brown, really made you a special executive, because your career at every turn, that was always the rap on you, was that you were and still deeply thoughtful, really could dissect material and communicate with writers and directors in a way that probably a lot of people can't.
Well, I sort of ended up boiling it down to that there were sort of two types of executives, the nerds and the popular kids. and by the way, the popular kids, I kind of have an envy of how adept they are at – there is a whole networking side of it, tracking scripts, being able to like do that whole part of the job that involves getting to know people, getting – you know, a kind of a network of relationships and being able to work that in order to turn it into business. People who are really strong at that. And then there are people who like are the nerds, who are mostly like rooted in the reading and the writing, connecting with writers probably about their work or filmmakers about their work. And eventually both types have to learn the other skill set.
For sure.
You might have the one that's your comfort zone, but mm-hmm. you eventually have to be capable of doing both. But naturally, yes, it always came to me more easily to read something and then be able to talk about it than to do the sort of schmoozy thing. I did the schmoozy thing. I would go out for a lot of lunches. I did a lot of lunching, but it was never my favorite part. I would probably always rather sit and read at lunch than go out to lunch.
Hey, before we continue on, do you know that every car comes with a chair of stories? That ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up a first date? The luxury package you got after a big promotion? Or the mileage you saved by riding your bike all summer? While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with TrueCar, you can at least find out what your car is worth when it's time to sell it or trade it in. Just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Then answer a few simple questions. Once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. True cash offer not available in all areas.
The King of Celebrity Gossip is now on Podcast One.
Kim Kardashian, I think she's nice, but obnoxious and annoying.
Check out the Perez Hilton Podcast with Chris Booker each week to get your fill on the latest news in show business and beyond. And nothing is off the table.
I think he should take her last name when they get married. He's already her bitch. He should just be her bitch officially.
Check out the Perez Hilton Podcast every week on Podcast One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
This is The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Well, let's jump ahead to you working at Disney and me working at Touchstone.
Because
that's, I mean, obviously you had, you know, you worked at DreamWorks. You came up with the Ants. We talked about that. One of the writers of Ants credits you of having that idea. So then you come to Disney and you're working for David Vogel, and I'm now working for Donald DeLine, which is interesting. And,
yes, exactly.
And you, what was your primary job there? Because I know from my side, and we can kind of connect the dots.
Yeah, let's connect the
dots. What was your primary duty at Disney? So the way, for people who may not know, the way that it was worked, forget about Hollywood Pictures for a second, but the way it was really worked out, it was Disney and Touchstone were sort of competitive, and it was always this conversation when we'd have these giant meetings with Jeffrey and Michael Eisner, what is a Disney movie? And we'd always say, well, why aren't we making Star Wars? Why aren't we making Raiders of the Lost Ark? Why aren't we making the superhero movies? They're in the parks for crying out loud. Why aren't we doing that? And it all came down to ownership and control. And Disney really wanted, and specifically Michael Eisner, really wanted to control all of the content, and they didn't want, you know, Lucas telling, you know, him what to do. And obviously Pixar, then, you know, they had their issues later, but we were really competitive, and it was always sort of a struggle of like, well, what is a Touchstone movie and what is a Disney movie? And specifically, I was probably very competitive with Vogel, and wasn't really, and, you know, didn't really know you at that time because they kept us apart, which is bizarre because we're in the same building. What was your primary responsibility? Like, what were you being told as you came up with through the ranks at Disney? What was your first job at Disney?
Okay, so well, first I have to go back a little bit. So I worked for Walter Parks and Laurie MacDonald when they're a production company. Then a year and a half into that time, because they were – I learned a lot about development, but they weren't making very many movies. I wanted more experience. I then, for the first time, got to voluntarily leave to go to a new job at Universal as a director-level executive.
Okay.
And I loved being a studio executive. I was like, this is it. I love this. I love the volume. I love the variety. I love the action. I love how much I'm learning. Like, it was just a crash course.
And so, you're a buyer, so everybody's coming to you. So that part of you that you didn't necessarily, quote-unquote, have of having to go out and schmooze is taken away because everybody's calling
you. And I loved it. Loved that job. And so from there, I sort of worked my way up the ranks. I end up, after 5 years at Universal, going to DreamWorks, where I happened to be working for Walter and Laurie again, but I had been introduced to Spielberg by Nora Ephron, actually, who I had developed a project with. She introduced me to Spielberg. He brought me over, and Walter and Laurie were there as well. So now I'm working for them again, but as an executive at DreamWorks. And so I was there for about 2.5 years, and I was ambitious, and I wanted to grow, and I wanted to be head of production, and they brought in somebody else to do that job, and I was bummed, and I wanted to move somewhere where either I could grow or, and this is the great irony of this, my wife was just having our first son. I looked to somebody like Lucy Fisher as like that, the super stable second, you know, in command.
Right.
Who has like a lot of freedom and a lot of independence and works on their movies. And maybe they're not going after the top job. Just enjoying this place of influence and working on movies. And I was like, that might be the right place for me to be in my life right now. Right. So I didn't go to Disney with an eye on that top job. It was the first time that I was like, no, I think I would like to try to emulate the Lucy Fisher model.
So you were going to come in as the elder statesman executive under David Vogel.
Correct.
And be stable and have a lot of room to play in that giant sandbox and influence the movies that are being made there.
Right.
Which
and have my relationships and all of that stuff and just work on the things that I loved. And he at that point had touched – he had Hollywood and – Disney. So the idea was, you know, you'll do Disney movies, but you'll also be able to do other kinds of films. And, you know, I want the seasoned person. And I was warned, by the way, that he was a tough guy to work for. I had worked with a lot of difficult men at that stage in my career, and I'd always been fine with them. I got there. I was like, say, we were newly parents. My wife had our son Noah when I was there. And
what was your title? EVP?
EVP.
Okay.
And but for one, the first thing I noticed was that a lot of the movies that they were making for Disney were like – they were movies that they thought kids would like as opposed to movies that they liked – that were appropriate for kids.
Right.
Right. So when I got there, I mean, they were making, which I loved. When I got there, they were making The Parent Trap, which I loved. But they were also making, like, My Favorite Martian and Mighty Joe Young. And I was like, who are those movies actually for?
Right.
Because I'm not psyched to see them. My kids aren't psyched to see them. Like, who's psyched to see those movies? But the way that he also corralled me in to take the job was that there had been two things that I had lost to Disney as an executive at DreamWorks. I had lost Enchanted and I had lost Sixth Sense. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you'll be able to work on those movies.
Right.
And so I was like, okay, well. And so I get there and it's a culture shock, right? Over at Amblin, they got like the – they serve you lunch and it's so cozy and they have the fireplaces and then they have like the movie theater with the popcorn and it's just so familial.
And Steven Spielberg is walking around.
People bringing their dogs.
Right.
And then I get to Disney and in fact, it's kind of brutal. And David is really tough and he's really tough, not mostly on me, mostly on others, but that I find unbearable,
mm-hmm.
right? And so
And did you instantly feel the competition within the company on the politics within the company?
Yes.
And it was also such a weird time because this is when Ovitz is being brought in, Jeffrey's leaving, Joe's being brought in, Eisner is trying to figure out we just bought ABC, so Bob Iger's there. It was such an odd time. The animation, Peter Schneider's making a run. So we were just getting bombarded from all sides. And the difference between you and I is I started at Disney as a CE, and let me say Disney, I mean Touchstone, and kind of worked my way up to get to that EVP level, to be that number two person when you're in my world, then collide. And I found, man, back in the day, like I started the day after Pretty Woman was released. It was just those were the grinding notes that we would just do, 25, 30 pages of notes and dump them on writers. And it was all the same shit. It was all, 90% of the notes were just rhetoric so that we felt like we read the script. The deep thinking at that point was tough. I mean, it was mostly just, form over substance.
Right.
And so by the time you and I got to be EVPs, it was a calm down a little and we were trying to dig in.
Right,
and
Jeffrey was at DreamWorks at that point. So
right.
The culture had sort of shifted. It was, Eisner, and then there was the animation side. And yes, I was aware of the politics, but also because David was very territorial and was like, don't even talk to them. Don't even talk to them.
Right.
And you're like, okay.
Right.
But it was also like our brands were very different. Obviously, we were focused on the Disney brand, then the Hollywood Picture stuff. So I was working on Sixth Sense.
Mm-hmm.
We were trying to develop Enchanted. And so we had, I had my hands full because I had a new child, but mostly I started to have a lot of doubts about my decision because the culture was so harsh.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up to Joe Roth and said to him about 6 months in, mm-hmm. 6-7 months in, went to him and said, I think I made a big mistake. Like, I think I made a mistake. And I just, the culture is so different. And I think I made a mistake. And he's like, you know what? Go back to your office. Go just do what you're doing. Keep your head down. And don't think that anything that happens in the next 3 weeks has anything to do with the conversation we've just had.
Right.
I'm like, okay. So I listen to him. He's like, just don't do anything for 3 weeks. So I go and I do nothing for 3 weeks. And the next thing I know, David leaves and you and I get – and Donald leaves, right?
Yeah.
David and Donald, like, write one after another.
Fast.
And then all of a sudden, yes. You and I are partners.
Well, let me give you the other side of it, which I must have talked about. So from my side, Donald was the first person to be let go. And they were on a retreat, I think in Sun Valley or somewhere. And it went down. And I get a call from Donald. And he goes, hey, just so you know, David's getting the job. And you and I both know your primary job was to just irritate David Vogel by trying to do his movies. I bought Enchanted, by the way.
Right.
And so
– oh, that's right.
Yeah.
So Enchanted came later.
Yes. And so he goes – so – and this is Donald.
Right. So Enchanted came
later.
So
I'm just saying you're not going to want to work for David. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to want to work for David Vogel. He's going to kill me. So I call Joe. He says to me, go back to your office. Keep your head down. If you want – I'll just give you your two accounts with Jerry and Sandler till this whole thing shakes out. And I go, well, that'd be great. And he goes, don't worry. And I said, okay. So I then meet with Vogel, who's like, I think you and I both know this is not going to work out. And I'm like, yeah, I completely agree. So I'll just take Jerry and Sandler and then we'll figure it out. And you could see that no one had told him that. And he was completely baffled, like, why aren't you freaking out that I'm about to fire you? I guess then he called Joe and he said, I think you and I and Nina should go to dinner. And I think you and I and Vogel went to dinner and he said, you're going to be my guys. You two are going to be my guys. And I had the same conversation you had. So I'm just like, well, I'm just going to keep my head down and see how this shakes out. And then he was gone and about 6 weeks later and you and I got the co-president gig. And that was awesome. And I thought we...
Although I was terrified at first. When you and I were first partnered, because we were so different and, your taste was so different than mine and you had all of these strengths. And then I was really terrified when you left, and I'll tell you why. But, you had all the relationships of, the Bruckheimer relationships. You had all the comedy relationships. And we were so different. And also, Yeah, it had been very politicized between the two divisions, and we'd sort of been to like stay away from them. And so suddenly, you know, we're like an arranged marriage, and we are so different from each other.
Right.
But we just kind of got along.
Yeah.
I think we were both a little bit surprised.
I wasn't. You're a lovely person. Right. I'm a lot harder to get along with.
Well, you know, I was just like didn't know how it was going to work, but I was – I mean, and it was so paradoxical too because I had just – come to Disney because I was no longer pursuing that job.
Right.
Right. And that I just wanted to be like in my Lucy Fisher job.
Right.
And so now we're partnered. And actually it was great for me, for one, because, you know, I got to see the benefit of having a partner who has a really different skill set. And I'm like, look how much more expansive our taste is.
Right.
If your relationships, your taste, you know, the comedies, which were not my strong suit, and, you know, the Bruckheimer relationship, the Michael Bay relationship, I was like, this is great. You know, we're much better together than we are apart. And it's a big job and it's a lonely job.
Yeah.
And it was nice. We had our little his and hers offices.
We did, with one common area.
With a common area. And
I have to say, for me, I leaned on you a lot in story. And so I would love to sit in meetings with you and dissect scripts and listen to you give notes. It was really fascinating to see how you could really dig, you know, way deeper than I was doing at the time. And I have again, that's why I said I wish I had more time to learn from you. But it was a really fun experience. And being in those meetings and also just being able to deflect from each other and protect each other. Because, you know, when you're one person, people, you know, agents can sometimes surround you and you feel like you're just like the wildebeest getting manipulated on all sides from different hyenas. And when you have two people, that's all it takes. You can have much more strength against all those opposing forces. So at that point, then you and I both have the job. It was a great experience. I end up leaving.
Right.
Because politically, I couldn't work for Peter Schneider. And so I did feel a deep, deep connection to Joe, as did you. What was it like to be then now isolated by yourself in this job? And I'm sorry, by the way. But you're fine.
Well, it was terrifying, first of all. So it's terrifying because nobody knows I'm pregnant, right?
Right.
So this is our second kid. I'm pregnant now. So having a partner is like the best thing ever, right?
Right.
You're going to be a team. And I remember saying, like, don't go, please stay. And so now I'm on my own. And I, of course, have to tell Peter, you know, and I'm working for somebody, yes, who's his first time in this job.
Right.
We didn't
really know a lot about live action. He had come from animation, which was my problem, because he was kind of ruffling all my relationships by saying things like, when we were shooting Pearl Harbor, we're going to get options on every actor. Like just the kind of, you know, easy thing you should know in that job. He didn't know any of it. And it was just driving me crazy.
But so it was terrifying. And then there was also the fact that we had this really thriving comedy business. And it's just those types of comedies – like, I don't have the gut for them. There's a type that I have a gut for.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I could do Bringing Down the House. I could do Sweet Home Alabama. Like, I had ones that I got. But then the whole ones that you got that were the bigger, broader ones, I just didn't get them. And so when you first left, I would try to do them, and I would totally pick the wrong ones because I didn't know a difference between one that was like a good one and a not good one. Like, I couldn't tell. And so
right.
we made some kind of cuckoo decisions, like, and made some really odd films like Bubble Boy, the Rob Schneider one where he's like in a sorority.
Hot Chick. Was that
yeah,
was
Hot
called?
Chick, Hot Chick. Although I really liked the filmmaker. But right. yeah, I was like, okay, I have to come to grips with the fact that I can't import taste that I don't have. I have to accept that I have. If I don't get it, don't do it. Don't try to do it because you think Todd would do it or he would
right.
be good at it. You're just going to have to accept that, yes, you can borrow somebody else's enthusiasm. You know, like, it might take a little while for me to fall in love with something if one of my executives is excited about it. But ultimately, I have to get it. And if I don't get it, I can't make the right choices because
right.
I just fundamentally don't get it. And I have to let myself off the hook that, yes, my taste is not going to be as broad as Todd and my taste work together.
So you leave Disney. We don't have to talk about the specifics of that. It's been well documented. And you start Color Force. First of all, what what is the significance of Color Force? How did you name your company?
Well, so it's funny because as an executive, you know that you're going to be fired at some point.
Uh-huh.
And so I used to think, like, well, what am I going to call my production company when I'm fired? I know I'll want to bring my dog to the office. I know then. But what will I call it? And I never would have a good name. I never wanted to call it, like – but I literally used to, like, drive and think to myself, what will I name my company when I'm fired? And so I started doing this deep dive on, like, names and domains and what was available. And I ended up looking at – it was like – I think it was like called like a visual dictionary. It was one of those – I was just really trying to get inspiration. And I come across this thing called the color force. And it's a quantum physics term. It's an invisible force. And the more these kind of invisible, you know, quantum level elements pull apart, the stronger the color force becomes.
Right.
Right. It's at its strongest when things are most torn apart, and then it's at its weakest when they are most together. And the idea of an invisible force that holds things together appealed to me. Plus, I liked the sound of the name, and I thought it sounded cool, like a kind of gay superhero troupe or whatever. I just thought it sounded
awesome.
Cool. But I liked that idea conceptually.
So most – I mean, your resume is just insane in terms of what you've produced. You've produced the Hunger Games franchise, Pose, American Crime Story franchise. You've done Crazy Rich Asians. You did Diary of a Wimpy Kid franchise, all pretty much based on books. So when you started your company, first of all, what do you think makes a great producer? And how do you have the patience and the confidence to just wait and only do the stuff you love? That's the thing I'm most impressed by you, is that you just wait for the stuff. You said it. That's why I said it was a great segue. You said, I'm not going to try to do what someone else does. I'm going to just do what I love. How did you have the confidence and the patience to do that?
Well, I mean, I really do. I'm very thankful, actually, to Dick Cook, because he was a big believer in, I don't want to see your executives running around with P&Ls. Like, they were – he and Michael Eisner were really big on, like, you have to go with your gut. You have mm-hmm. to go with your gut. You're not going to be right every time, but it's all about your gut. And that really did stay with me. And we had so many movies to make that I got to have a lot of experiences of, like, okay, I went with my gut, and it either did or didn't work. If it didn't work, why didn't it work? Oh, I didn't go with my gut.
Right.
And things that I didn't go with my gut almost always – I ended up regretting. Anytime I got myself talked into something, those would be the ones that I would regret. Even if I would fail at one that I did love, at least I could live with the failure because I knew that it came from the right place. It was unbearable to live with failures of movies where I hadn't listened to my gut. And then as a producer, though, yeah, it was terrifying, right? The first year or so were utter terror. As you know, suddenly, you know, you don't get a call unless you make a call. You're like out in the wilderness by yourself. I mean, I had a home at DreamWorks, but I happened to be there during a time of transition mm-hmm. where they didn't have like movies to give me or anything like that. But one thing that they did give me, which ended up not getting made, but they gave me Wednesday, that Massey Tagetin had written to produce with Brad Simpson. And it was a pre-strike movie. We were trying to get it made for the before the strike. And Brad and I really hit it off. And I was able to really see somebody who'd been in the trenches a lot. He'd made a lot of indie films. And we got into pre-production. It was my first time being a producer in pre-production. Right. I was like, it's really exciting. It's really amazing. We have this great collaboration. And then the whole thing unraveled and just went down the toilet. But that relationship with Brad became super important as time went on. But also, I got my first taste of like, wow, this is exciting.
Right.
This, like, the hiring the department head, the being there as some nothing becomes something.
Yeah.
But trying to find things that I loved, also realizing that when I would stretch and try to talk myself into loving something, then as a producer, you no longer have the option you have as an executive of saying, like, ooh, that was a mistake. Let's take it out behind the shed and mm-hmm. kill it.
Right.
You're, like, married to it forever.
Right.
Like, once you've told somebody, oh, I want to do your project, you can never really, certainly in the early years of my career, say, you know, I was wrong about that.
Right.
I don't really want to do it
right anymore.
And it was like having to have sex with somebody you don't like every night forever, right? And so it was like, and as opposed to as an executive, you could just dump them, right? You would just be like, okay, we tried,
right.
It didn't work. Like, pfft. So
right.
I was all of a sudden realized, no, if I do things that I don't like, I am stuck with them. And so I started to be more discriminating and just have to make peace with I'm going to put more time into fewer things, mm-hmm. right? I'm going to lean into the things I believe in, and I am not going to talk myself into things I don't.
And how are you finding that material?
You know, it was, you know, hustling and having – I had, you know, good executives around me, and I hustled. And they hustled. But in the case of Wimpy Kid, actually, Carla Hacken had, you know, come across the book. It was already selling really well. Nobody had thought of it as a movie because it was young protagonist, and it was both – it had, you know, drawings and a diary format. She shared the book with me. She said, you know, I would like to do this, but I need somebody who makes people believe in it more. And, you know, you have the Disney background. Would you do it? And I love the book. I had my first sort of experience of – I actually asked Brad to come onto it with me because I felt like, you know, I'll be better with him than not. And I really learned a lot about – what a good partnership is mm-hmm. from our experience. And so he joined up and, you know, I won over, you know, along the way after first had to get Jeff Kinney to trust me with his material. And he was super protective of it. Felt like this is the most valuable asset I have. And if it goes wrong, you know, this thing that could be like, you know, my whole future for my family financially could all go down the toilet, not to mention something I created that means so much to me. And so
– But you've had that time and time again too. You had that in The Hunger Games. You had that in Crazy Rich Asians. You've had – I don't know if – I'm assuming you had that with Ryan Murphy when you were trying to convince
yes.
him to do American Crime Story. So you've always been up against it to try to convince people that you're the right person to trust their one or biggest asset.
Yes.
To.
I mean that's certainly a big part of the job, and I learned a lot from the experience with Jeff. And then I could also have other people going forward. When The Hunger Games came around, I was able to say, like, you can talk to Jeff Kinney and ask whether I meant it when I said that I loved it and I would protect it.
Right.
And so
– And that's so important because you're obviously a person of your word and have great integrity and are really honest and have always lived your life openly and honestly. And if you f***ed over that first guy, you're done because
right.
you can't say that. And someone's going to say, hey – she did this to the, you know, Jeff, he'll do it to you, and then you're screwed. So you have to be a person of your word and in this business and say what you mean what you say. Otherwise, you're not going to get very far. And there's been stories, I think Billy Ray told a story about he was, at a class, and this kid said, I want to be a producer. And he goes, but I don't really want to read. I just want to produce. And so, like, that's what give producers a bad name.
Yeah.
And so those of us who have done it for so long, taste aside, you have to at least have a moral integrity and be honest and be a person of your word. Otherwise, you're never going to get very far.
That's right. And you have to be honest with the good and the bad. But I learned also a lot. What I found when we started to do Wimpy was that when I was at Disney, you know, and we started to really sort of transform the live action brand and bring things over from Touchstone, like Remember the Titans, mm-hmm. to say this can be a Disney
right.
movie if we clean up some of the language.
Yeah.
And, you know, what – That something like Enchanted, which you had now, right, that's right, remember, had
yeah.
been a Touchstone movie. This can be a Disney movie.
Absolutely.
Right? That starting to see, having this brand and knowing, like, okay, this is my North Star. I have this brand. It's like a beloved, trusted, powerful brand. How do I both honor it and expand upon it?
Right?
That became what these books were for me. And I think
right.
it was part of why I was so gravitated toward books is that I liked having a religion. I liked having a North Star.
I see.
I liked having something to protect, to believe in, something that I knew the feeling it made me have. And I could go and try to hold on to that feeling and make sure that the decisions that we made would sustain that feeling. And I would always say to authors about adapting their work, you know, it's not about – you're not the movie won't be just like the book, but it has to feel like the book.
Right.
And that feeling became like a really guiding force for me. And I do think it came down to that experience of like a brand management experience at
From Disney.
Disney.
Right.
And that was how I talked Suzanne Collins into doing Hunger Games. Was to say, like, this is the brand, right? And here's what's special about it. Here are the things that would be horrible if they were lost. Here are the ways I could see it going wrong. Like, you're walking this razor's edge of where you have a really controversial subject matter, but it's communicated with such compassion and respect. You always care about Katniss. And there's a version of this movie that is softened, where mm-hmm. you age up the protagonists and you take the teeth out. There's a version of it that's exploitive, where it's stylized and hyper-violent and is celebrating what the book condemns. Mm-hmm. And to walk that line, you need somebody who actually understands like how to protect something precious. And I think that that's what I can do. And so that kind of protective mode ended up being really valuable in the adaptation business because it really helped me and it helped me to understand like what my task was. And so and then that can be extended when you get to a voice, right? Mm-hmm. And so that voice of Ryan Murphy or that voice of Peter Hedges, who we just did Ben is Back with, or of Joe Robert Cole, who we just did All Day and a Night with for Netflix Independent Division, that becomes my North Star. Like, I tend to need something to love and believe in and want to protect.
Well, you certainly did it with Crazy Rich Asians also.
Yes.
And Pose. I mean, those things where you just – you and everything I read about Crazy Rich Asians and the decisions that you made time and time again, first of all, hiring John and his passion for it and believing in him from another failed thing and just remembering him and knowing how perfect he'd be, just keeping that North Star of never wavering from, you know, the producer that said to John, yeah, let's make the girl, white. It'll be so much better. It just throws everything off. And you're always walking that razor's edge, which is – it's hard enough to make a good movie. It's hard enough to make a commercial movie. But to do both time and time and time and time again, where do you find your greatest strengths as a producer? And how do those greatest strengths allow you to walk this tightrope?
Well, I think that, I know what I love, and then I do. I have a very protective impulse of like, okay, I know what I love. I know what makes this special, right? And I know that movies have two fundamental impulses. They want to be bad, and they want to fall apart,
right?
Hmm? TV, I would say, actually is a different proposition, which is they also want to be bad, but they want to happen.
Right.
Right. And so it's not always about putting the gas on, sometimes about putting the brakes on, saying it's not good enough yet, we shouldn't do it yet.
Right.
But knowing, so you're always having to be leaning in, pushing it forward, holding it together, keeping it from falling apart. But you're also having to look at all of the ways in which intention can get diluted and how easy it is, especially once you get to this point where you're close to a yes. To decide, well, it must be good enough. Mm-hmm. If they're willing to do it, it must be good enough. And that's not always true.
Right.
That you shouldn't be waiting for somebody else to tell you it's good enough. Like, you have to just keep interrogating it. Is it good enough? Is it good enough? And good enough, not so much by, like, some standard of mine, but more of, like, I've identified, again, like, what is this North Star? And if it's and it shifts too, because it becomes too like, what is the best movie John Chu can make? What is everything great and amazing about John Chu? And how do I create an environment where everything that's great and amazing about him can be unleashed and protected? You know, or what's great and amazing about this book? And how do I create an environment in which that is protected?
Right.
And what needs to change? And how do I make sure that I keep my partners, you know, on board, even though we will make departures from the source material or from the original intention.
Right.
And so but there is – I find for me, you know, I need a North Star. That really helps me. And that can be – but that can be a person's voice, which
right.
is because that inspires me. I loved when we were at Disney Touchstone Hollywood, I loved the writer-directors. I loved the person who had a whole vision in their head. But it's always been for me about what is the best version of what you can do. And so there is kind of a part of it where I don't think of myself like Jerry Bruckheimer, and I admire him for this. He is a brand. There is a brand of movie which is a Bruckheimer movie.
Yep.
And that brand is something that a filmmaker who would make a very different movie somewhere else under Jerry would make a movie that clearly was identifiable as a Jerry Bruckheimer movie, even if you took the credits off.
Right.
I don't really think that's true for us because for me, each one, the brand is the material and the talent.
I agree.
How do I make sure that they walk away feeling like that was the best workout I could have done, and right. and the environment was created for that to happen. I would say, though, on the flip side, that the dirty little secret of producing is that you're actually only as good of a producer as your director will let you be. And somebody who doesn't want to hear from you, you can't – I can't direct the movie. First of all, I don't want to. I can't. I wouldn't be good at it. I don't want to direct the movie.
Right.
I want to have a collaboration with the person. And if the person just doesn't want that, your skill set is super limited by their level of receptivity. So right. that's another big factor, which is choosing the right partner and somebody who actually wants to have a give and take and respects and trusts you enough to know that you respect and trust them.
Right. Great advice. So all that being said, just the first thing that comes to your head, because you've made so many great movies, can you think of one moment where you're like, holy shit, I'm a producer and this is f***ing awesome? One moment in all of this that sort of stands out.
I would say that – I mean, I could think of a couple. But for one, I think one moment that's very memorable to me was – so after we did the first Hunger Games, originally Gary Ross was supposed to write and direct the next one and – or certainly supposed to direct the next one. And the studio executive part of me, during the making of the first movie, I can remember literally like the first days of shooting, I was calling the studio about like, what are we doing about the next one? And they're like, well, Gary wants to do it, so we're just going to have to wait. And, you know, like the studio executive part of me like is like, red flag, red flag, red flag. But I was like, okay. And then we're in post and it's still not really moving forward. He finally realizes, like, I'm not going to be able to write it for myself. I'll have somebody else write it sort of under my supervision. And then that wasn't particularly moving forward very much. And then we're now like 4 months before we're supposed to start. And he's like, you know, I just am not into it.
Wow.
And you could kind of have – you could kind of tell along the way. Like you can tell when somebody's like in the early stages of pregnancy with a movie.
Right.
And I was like, it doesn't feel like we're in those stages. And so now we're like 4 months out from when we're supposed to start. And I do not have a script. And I do not have a director, but I have a book that I love, and I like dive in to the process, and we're right in the thick of it. And I talk to Suzanne Collins all the time, and I'm talking to her during this period, and she's like, you know, Nina, this is a crazy thing, but I've never heard you sound this happy before. Like, you love this. You love this. And I was like, yeah.
Wow.
I do. Like, I kind of love that this is a moment where, like, a producer is required.
Right.
I need to hold it together. Like, the you know, it's pulling yeah. apart. I need to hold it together, and I need to make sure it's good. And, you know, I was able to make a couple of decisions that really paid off with both, you know, Michael Arndt, who knocked it out of the ballpark on his first go so quickly, and Francis, who was an amazing partner who went on to do all the movies with us. And with Suzanne as like this sort of, you know, the protecting, you know, mother of it all. And we were able to pull it together. And it was a moment of like, this is what it is, right? And I love it. I do. I love the having to spring into action and knowing that, like, it comes down to, are you going to be able to hold it together right now? And are you going to be able to protect it?
Right.
And so there was that. And I would also say that the point at which we went out with Crazy Rich Asians, which we had done and made a bunch of decisions, which was to do it outside of the system, and then John came on, and then we had, you know, his amazing presentation, which we had tweaked a little bit, and then we're going to take that out to the world and decide what to do with it. That also was like an incredibly exciting moment of like, how do I hold this thing together? How do I protect it? And now we have taken this thing, which could have so easily gotten lost in the shuffle. And now we have like multiple folks who are interested. We have to choose the right one, but we're going to make this movie. Like,
right.
we're going to come out of this week with a green light of this movie.
That's
and
exciting.
That was super exciting. So I would say some of those moments.
That's amazing. Well, yeah. you've had an incredible career. And I'm sure you'll have a lot more of these moments down the line. Thank you so much for coming in and putting a voice to the name that we've heard so much on my podcast. And I really, really am thankful that you did this. I love you so much. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks.
All right.
Glad we got to walk down memory road a little.
It was very fun. Thanks.
All right. See you.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use hashtag Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.
Hey, this is Jordan Harbinger. I used to host the Art of Charm podcast, but now it's time for something new. The Jordan Harbinger Show. Did you know you can be entertained and actually get a boost in your life at the same time? On this show, we dig into the superpowers of the world's most interesting thinkers and top talents. Then we deliver them to you right into your ears. But I get it. We're not all superheroes. That's why we give you their blueprint so you can live what you listen. After 1,000 interviews, learning 5 languages, and getting arrested in a country that doesn't even exist anymore, I'm now more ready than ever to introduce you to The Jordan Harbinger Show. Listen free to The Jordan Harbinger Show, available on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the Podcast One app.